stands in your shoes to dole out the inheritance to the beneficiary in such method as the trustee deems appropriate. There's another part of a trust that is also helpful. It's called a spendthrift clause, and it sounds rather ominous. But a spendthrift clause says that if a beneficiary's beneficial interest is threatened to be diverted, the trustee will withhold distribution of that beneficial interest until the diversion is gone. I'll give you the only example that fits that I've dealt with. Happened 25 years ago, I suppose, maybe 20 years ago. A trustee came to see me. His brother had set up a trust for the brother's son, and brother had died. And there was a couple $100,000 in this trust. Now, you go back to 2000, the year 2000, a couple $100,000 in a trust was a pretty fair chunk of change, today. Well, as it turns out, the beneficiary was about 18 or 19 years old when he was involved in a car accident of some sort and ended up, didn't have enough insurance and ended up with about $100,000 judgment against him. And so here comes the lawyer for the injured party, who happened to be a good buddy of the guy. You know, he's crashed his car up and the buddy was a passenger in the car. So what happened is the attorney for the buddy comes saying, well, you owe us $100,000, pay up. And the trustee said, do I have to do that? And my question was, I don't know. Can I see your trust? In the trust was the spendthrift clause. And I said, not only do you not have to pay it, you cannot pay it. However, going further in the trust under trustee's authority, the trustee had the authority to settle that claim, which we settled for. Well, the guy told his buddy, he says, hey, he says, we'll pay you $40,000. The two kids are talking about this. The lawyer didn't want to tell his client that, because the lawyer wanted to get the whole $100,000. And bottom line is we settled it full release for $40,000. And the kid who was injured was happy as a clam because he got a bunch of money and his insurance had picked up all the other expenses. And he ended up with, bottom line, he ended up with about $30,000 in his pocket and he's happy. The attorney was the one who was really unhappy because his fee would have been much higher. And his client would have got much more money though too. But that's what a spendthrift clause will do in a trust. It will protect the assets in the trust from dissipation. There was another case, I'm not gonna tell you about it, but it involved a very large distribution from a trust to a guy who got a divorce, and the judge ordered him to pay huge maintenance costs. And the only place the money was coming from was the trust, and the trustee says, I'm not gonna pay it. And the court said, oh yes, you are. And the Supreme Court said, the spendthrift clause prevails. They're not gonna pay it. You're gonna have to change your maintenance order. Okay. Sometimes we need a trust for a disabled child. Those are generally called supplemental needs trusts. A supplemental needs trust is if you have a child who is developmentally disabled, for all intents and purposes is going to receive some sort of public benefits for their entire life. If they were to receive a benefit from your estate, you die and their benefits $50,000. They lose all of their state benefits, medical payments, SSI, whatever it is. They lose those until they spend the $50,000. With a supplemental needs trust, we can take a sum, put it into that trust, and it pays for the, quote, supplemental needs of that disabled child. Now, we also refer to it as a luxury trust, because those supplemental needs are those things other than basic food, clothing, or shelter. Those can't be paid for. That is what your public benefits are for, food, clothing, and shelter. You can use the money in that supplemental needs trust, for example, to buy the, depending upon the child's disability and the level of disability, maybe you can buy them a car that they can have for their use. Maybe the trust owns it, but they can have a car if they can use it. I'll give you a couple of examples of some of the uses that we have had. I had one case where it was a disabled adult child, and the adult child was between 55 and 60 years old. And she had the mental and emotional ability of about a 5 or 6 year old. Very smiley, happy person, very easily disappointed. She loved cartoons. In particular, she loved Mickey Mouse. And this was a long time ago. And what we did with some of the money in that supplemental needs trust is one of the things that we did was we bought her a new TV set and we bought her a VCR. That's how long ago it was. It was a VCR, not a DVD player, a VCR. And I think we also bought her like 10 or 12 videotapes. And she would sit for hours watching those videotapes over and over and over. And at some point we realized there was more, but her needs were other than that, very simple. She didn't really want anything else. And we had a fair sum of money in that trust. And there was nobody else to get it other than the state of Wisconsin. Whatever was left over when she died, in her case, was going to go to the state of Wisconsin. So what we did was we found someone who would act as her, I'll use the word chaperone, took her to Disneyland, or Florida, Disney World. Oh, she just had a phenomenal time. Cost us $10,000, but so what? You know, it's $10,000 that she got a benefit for and just had a wonderful time. I have another situation where the disabled adult child, actually the disabled adult child is older than I am, and I'm 74. So he is a dyed-in-the-wool Packer fan. You go to his room and he's Packer stuff all over the place. And with him, we bought him a Packer jacket. We bought him he had some Packer clothes, but we bought him more. Why not? It's money that can be used for his benefit. And he was just absolutely ecstatic. We've had a couple of other ones where where the people like to do something like go out, simple as going out to eat. It's not basic food, it's special, you know? So that's what those supplemental needs trusts are for. I think I spent enough time on that. Trusts have a number of advantages. First of all, when you compare them to the cost of going through probate, they are very reasonably priced. The ones that I do, the trust itself, the most expensive one that I do is a trust package. It costs $2,000 plus whatever we have to do in real estate. And that's half the minimum cost of a probate. If you've got a $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 probate, if you're staring at that and you pay $2,000 for a trust, it's remarkably inexpensive. They are flexible. You can change them anytime you want. You can add to, you can take from, you can do almost anything you want to do with that trust. They avoid probate, as I said before. They avoid a guardianship of the estate. A guardianship of the estate is if you are no longer capable of managing your property, and if you do not have a power of attorney for finances and property, or called a general durable power of attorney, we have to go through a guardianship proceeding. We're going to talk about those in a few minutes. They're expensive, and they're controlled by the court. A trust avoids that because the trustee will be there to take care of your property. And if there's with the power of attorney for finances and property or durable power, they can take care of your legal needs. So we've got that taken care of in the trust. It's more easily distributed to beneficiaries. There is no court interference with a trust. If the trust says distribute, that's what you do. The trustee comes in, they give this to this person, that to this person, whatever it is, whatever it says in the trust, they do it. Now, as I said before, it might very well be that some of the things we want to do is hold on to some of this for 5 years, 10 years, a long period of time. We can do that with a trust, cannot do that in a state. The judge is going to say to you, get this thing off my calendar. If you've got to deed that farm to everybody, I don't care. Just get it off my desk. With a trust, the whole idea is to do it as quickly or as slowly as the family and the trustee deem appropriate. The other thing about a trust, and when I first started doing trusts, I didn't think this was necessarily high on the list, but a lot of people like the fact that trusts are secret. I mentioned the probates are public record. Here, we don't publish in the paper. Nobody knows what's in that trust. Nobody knows what you own. Nobody knows what you owe. Nobody knows who got what, except the people directly involved with the trust. And that would probably be the trustee, the beneficiaries, an attorney if necessary to handle some transactions, or it could be your accountant because you got to do some accounting work with a trust like you do with any other. If you look at the trust then as a business, you got to do some accounting work. And generally what that means is you got to determine whether or not you do need to do a tax return. If you have specific questions about trusts, I'll be glad to answer them towards the end. I could go on with these things. I could probably take up the rest of the day just talking about these things. I am a firm believer in avoiding probate, and one of the ways to avoid probate is to use a trust. Okay, let's move on to powers of attorney. Basically, there are a number of ways to look at powers of attorney, but there are two basic types of powers of attorney: powers of attorney for healthcare, powers of attorney for finance, property, or something like that. The power of attorney for healthcare, I'm gonna do that one first. It can be either statutory, which means it's a printed form. You can go online and get one. Do not do that. I have seen too many powers of attorney where somebody has gone online, they picked up the power of attorney. It's not Wisconsin specific, or is it even Wisconsin appropriate? It is inaccurately witnessed. It is inaccurately put together. It might be declared invalid at the time you need it the most. A statutory power of attorney can be picked up. Sue, does the ADRC do those?
We do have them printed off of the WAR website.
Okay. Through the ADRC, they can print you off the form, and it'll be a Wisconsin form. You simply have to fill it out properly. It does provide for, I'll use the word, limited coverage or authority, but it will do the case in about 90, it'll do the job in about 90% of the cases. The other type of healthcare power of attorney is a customized one. Only attorneys can do customized powers of attorney, whether it be finance or otherwise. And that's because we are going to guide you through the property and through the procedure and tell you what your rights are, what your benefits are, what's all going on with this. Whereas with the statutory, all you get is a printed form that says, this is what you got. A power of attorney is said to be durable if it stays in effect when the person becomes disabled. A healthcare power of attorney by nature must be durable, because if it's not, as soon as the principal becomes disabled, there's nothing there. So it is a durable power of attorney. A healthcare power of attorney is also described as a springing power of attorney. It springs into effect at some future time with some future event. And what that future event is a healthcare power of attorney does not become effective until two doctors have signed a document that states that you are unable to receive or communicate information to the extent that you're unable to make an informed healthcare decision. I like to say you are in no position to know what's going on. Okay. At that point, your healthcare agent will make whatever decisions are necessary on your behalf. Let's see here. With a healthcare power of attorney, there are certain standards that must be observed. First of all, it has to be witnessed by two uninterested parties. None of the witnesses may be related to you by blood or marriage. Okay. It has to be, again, it has to have a doctor to activate it. Generally speaking, they'll have either a primary and an alternate agent, or it might have two joint agents. Now, on a statutory, I don't use statutory powers of attorney myself. I see them from time to time. I do not believe the statutory power of attorney provides for joint agents. Over the years, I've preferred not to use joint agents, but last year or so, I've been moved to say, well, you know, if you can't get a hold of this one to make a decision, we can get a hold of this one to make a decision. So I've been more inclined to use joint powers or joint authority on healthcare powers of attorney. It has to be signed by two witnesses, again, unrelated. And one other thing I can tell you about a customized power of attorney, at least my power of attorney and the power of attorney that I've seen with some of the other agents who do this type of work, some attorneys that do this type of work, is that the agents are, let me back off on that. What we do is we include what's called a HIPAA release form. If you haven't heard of HIPAA, it stands for Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. What it means is that no entity or person having your medical information may release that information to any person except under three circumstances. Number one, there is a court-ordered guardianship of the person in force. Number two, there is an activated power of attorney for healthcare that is given to the person possessing the information. Or number three, a medical release. Insurance companies are really difficult to deal with. Maybe all you want to do is call up and say, well, I need to get some information about mom's health, insurance. I'm sorry, I can't talk to you under HIPAA rules. If you have the release, you can send them the release and they can tell you what you need to know. I've had that come up only a handful of times, but it was important to get it done each time it came up. The second form of power of attorney is the durable power of attorney. This is for finances, property, legal matters. Here, a person is appointed as your agent for financial affairs, usually has a primary and an alternate agent. Mine are immediate. The minute that thing is signed by the principal, that's the person making the power of attorney. The minute it's signed, it is in force. It is in effect. And the agent has authority to act. It does not mean they have to act, nor does it mean they should act. It simply means that we don't need to go down the road and have somebody else say, okay, this person's disabled now, you can act now. The agent can take over whenever it's appropriate to do so. Quite frankly, it is very rare for an agent to want to take any action until they absolutely have to. Sometimes they wait even too long, but the bottom line is that they can take over when they need to do that. Again, it can be statutory or customized. And a power of attorney for finance and property doesn't have to be witnessed. It should be notarized, although I've seen some that have two witnesses, and mine, we notarize them. Powers of attorney are sort of related to guardianships, and I'm going to talk about guardianships. If you need someone to handle your healthcare needs, you need an agent, someone to make healthcare decisions for you. Or it might be financial decisions. You need somebody to make financial decisions for you, but you don't have the power of attorney. At that point, chances are slim and none, and slim walked out the door, that you can't do it. And the only option is a guardianship. A guardianship is a court action. It is it actually is a probate action, but a guardianship action is a procedure whereby a person, usually a family member, but not in all cases. If there are no family members, it might be human services or somebody else that brings the action, where, again, usually a family member says, mom needs somebody to make medical decisions for her. We don't have anybody who can do that. Court, we're asking you to give me the authority to do this. By the time we're done doing a guardianship and getting that done through the court and getting all the reports and going to court, and we have to have a couple of hearings and so on and so forth. Generally speaking, it's going to cost about $3,000. A guardianship gives the same authority as a healthcare or financial power of attorney. If you have a power of attorney, in all but the most rare cases, the power of attorney negates the need for a guardianship. Those few cases where you might still need the power, the guardianship, where there's a power of attorney, is where one, the person named as the agent under the guardianship, the person named as the agent under the power of attorney is either unable or unwilling to serve. Maybe they died. Maybe they have a medical condition of their own. I can't do that right now. I just can't do it. In cases like that, where there is no other alternative, we have to go the guardianship route. There are some cases where the court deems the person who is, we're doing a guardianship because the person named in the power of attorney is an inappropriate choice. They're dissipating the individual's property, or they're not doing the job the way they're supposed to do it. I have personally not had that case come up. I know it comes up because I read about it about once a month in the cases that go through the appellate courts in Wisconsin, where somebody who is a guardian was abusing their authority or failing to act under their authority. In any event, guardianships are expensive and can be mostly avoided by a power of attorney. Oh, I'm getting out there, aren't I? Okay. If you have any questions about guardianships, I don't do a lot of them. I do a lot of powers of attorney, but in our firm, we probably only do, maybe three or four guardianships every year. And to us, we think that's a good thing because people are actually having their powers of attorney done. It doesn't matter if you've got a statutory, if you've got a customized power of attorney, they avoid guardianship. That's a good thing. Now I want to talk about some other planning tools. And there are any one of a number of, shall we say, items in our attorney's bag of tricks about what we can do to help you avoid probate. One of them is by the use of beneficiary or what we know as transfer on death designations. We can do it with bank accounts. We can do it with life insurance. We can do it with annuities. We can do it with retirement accounts. We can do it with stock bond mutual funds. We can actually even do it with real estate. That's a fairly new development in Wisconsin. All of these transfer on death designations transfer, they're called non-testamentary transfers, meaning that they transfer property outside of probate and they take priority over a will. For example, if you have your son named on your bank account as your transfer on death beneficiary on your bank account, and then you leave a will that says, I leave everything to my daughter, Mary. Mary doesn't get that bank account because the bank account was a non-probate transfer and it trumps the will. Okay. Now, having said that, yeah, let's say that your son died before that. Now that bank account is subject to the probate. One of the things that I talk about with transfer on death designations, and this comes up particularly in real estate, if you have a large family, transfers on death can become almost unwieldy, like I say, particularly with real estate, because if the real estate has to be sold and you've got 10 children named on a transfer on death, I got to track down 10 kids in order to sell it. And here's the scenario that I run into about twice a year. Okay, the 10 kids inherited it and five of them are still living. Five of them have died and we don't know when they died. We don't know where they died. We know they have children. We don't know where all their children are. And it makes it a nightmare trying to track down everybody so we can sell this piece of real estate. The easiest way that I know of if you've got one or two, fine. Transfer on death is fine to the kids. If you've got three, what's their relationship? Maybe it'll work. If there are more than three, I almost always recommend some form of a trust to be the entity that holds that property because then you have one person or two who are the trustees who can handle the sale of the property, and we don't need to find all 10 people. It works out slicker than a Dickens to do it that way. I've had any number of people come back and say, oh man, am I glad you did that, because we had trouble tracking down my brother in Oregon. He lives in a tent. I didn't make that up. In any event, the bottom line is that depending on what you have, we can use transfers on death in concert with the trust. In any event, there are some other things that we're going to talk about. But before we do that, I want to talk about some important terms. You may have heard some of these terms in other presentations. I'm going to touch on them here. Maybe I'm going to give you a slightly different definition than someone else gave. But we need to be aware of these things anytime we're doing estate planning. And the reason we need to be aware of these is because regardless of what anybody says, the elephant in the room is medical assistance in the nursing home. And when I say medical assistance, it's a medical assistance slash estate recovery and nursing home. So we have to be aware of what's going on in that situation. So the first thing we're going to talk about is divestment. The divestment occurs anytime you transfer property at less than fair market value. People say, oh, well, no, I'm not going to divest my house. I'll sell it for $10 and then it's a sale. Well, if your house is worth $100,000, it's actually a $10 sale and a $99,990 divestment. Smarter people than me figured all this stuff out. So I haven't figured out a way around it, and I don't know of anybody else that has either. A second thing is the look back period. You probably talked about that earlier. The look back period, and the way I use the look back period is I say, if you make a divestment, you deed your house to your kids. If you make a divestment, you are ineligible for medical assistance for 5 years, period. True, there are ways we can get around, not around it, we can cure that divestment. I'll talk about that when we get it. I'll talk about it right now. One of the problems is, let's say you've got four kids, you divest title of the house to your four kids, and you go for 3 years and now you need medical assistance and you're ineligible because of the divestment. Well, it's easy to say, okay, my kids will deed it back to me. Well, what if one of them has died and cannot deed it back to you? What happens if one of them now has a judgment against him or her and that judgment has stuck to his or her interest in that property? What happens is if I had this did happen in one case where it was money that was divested, and it was divested to five different children, four daughters and a son. The four daughters duly put the money away in a bank account, and they knew they had to wait for a period of time. Son took the money and spent it. He bought a boat. And you know, boat just means break out another thousand. That's all boat stands for. In any event, he spent the money. Okay, guess what? Dad all of a sudden ran out of money, needed medical assistance. Okay, kids, we got to give some of the money back. Daughter still had the money to give back. Son did not. Hey, well, I got some boat. You know, daughters gave it back, and they gave back enough to be able to take care of dad until he died. But son ended up keeping a bunch of money. Daughters did not get to keep. Son thought that was just fine. And I refused to do business with him later on when it came out. Anyway, so we've got the look back period is that period when you go into the nursing home and you're eligible for medical assistance. They look back 5 years. If you made a divestment in that period, you're ineligible unless you can get it back, in which case you spend the money. And when it's gone, then you're eligible again. Another thing I'm going to talk about that's important in estate planning is called the step up in basis. Basis is what you have in property for value, what you buy it for. You buy Blackacre for $50,000. That is your basis. When you sell it, it's worth $450,000. The capital gain is $400,000 because we deduct your basis, what you paid for it, from what you sell it for, and you pay tax, capital gains tax on the rest. A step up in basis occurs when someone dies. So if mom and dad bought Black Acre for $50,000 and dad dies when it's worth $450,000, mom gets Black Acre at a stepped up basis of $450,000. So if she sells it for $450,000, zero capital gains tax. That applies to children also. Mom and dad, so let's say mom gets it now at $450,000, mom dies a few years later and it's worth $600,000. Kids get the property for $600,000. If they sell it right now for $600,000, they pay zero capital gains tax. If they hold it for another 2 years and sell it for $700,000, they pay capital gains tax on everything over the $600,000 it was worth when mom died. That's the step up in basis. It is very important in estate planning. We count on it because mom and dad very commonly will not sell their property because they don't want to pay tax. They'll let their kids sell it and pay no tax, but that's how that works. Now, step up has been around for, I don't remember when there wasn't a step up in basis. So it's been around for at least the 40 or 50 years I've been in business. Well, I haven't been in business 50, yeah, close to 50 years. So one of the things about step up though, the Biden administration has also been making rattles about step up. The first thing they've talked about is in the capital gains tax area, is they're talking about increasing the capital gains tax rate from its current 20% to whatever the, like 35% or 39%, whatever the top bracket rate is. Supposedly that's only for people with income over $400,000. That's what they tell us. I don't know if I'd believe that. However, he's also talking about eliminating the capital or the step up in basis, which would affect all of us. It means that when the farm, my family farm, goes to my children, when we bought it 30 plus years ago, almost 40 years ago, we paid $55,000 for it. Now it's worth $550,000. I don't know if that's quite correct, but let's assume it is. All of a sudden, my children would be looking at, if they were to sell it, looking at paying zero tax as opposed to paying tax on $500,000. So that's a big deal, that step up in basis. I don't know where that's going to go. I don't know whether the politicians have any interest in protecting us, but that is a big, big deal. Okay. Lifetime gifts, I'm in favor of them. If you give away property, it's gone, okay? 5 years for the look back, but other than that, we've got, it's a good idea to reduce some of your estate. Now, do you all have the document entitled Real Estate Conveyance Options? Okay, I'm not gonna go over that in great detail because you can read it. But basically people say, I want to convey my property to my kids. What should I do? And the answer is there are really three ways of doing it. One is to convey it with a life estate, which means you own it for all intents and purposes until you die. And when you die, it goes to your children, stepped up basis, outside probate. That used to be have your cake and eat it too. They changed that in 2014. If you have received medical assistance, if you make the conveyance today, you go 5 years, you're now eligible for medical assistance. But that life estate is deemed to have value by the state of Wisconsin. And if you receive medical assistance, when the property is sold, they can receive up to the amount of medical assistance you received based on the value of your life estate. It's a very complex subject. I commonly take 15 or 20 minutes just explaining that, but I'm going to use this example. Let's say that you have a house, and I'm going to use $100,000 because $100,000, I can multiply that in my head pretty easily. If I use anything more than that, I'm a lawyer. If I could do math, I'd have been a doctor. There is a table, it's called, from the medical assistance handbook, there is a table, it's called the life estate and remainder interest value. The value of a life estate doesn't go under 30% until age 89. And at age 89, the value of a life estate is 29.5%. So let's say that you have a house worth $100,000 when you die with a life estate, and you conveyed it with a life estate, and you receive $50,000 in medical assistance. The state of Wisconsin, when that house is sold, can receive $29,500 back under estate recovery for the value of your life estate. On the other hand, if you only receive $5,000 in medical assistance, that's all they'll get. It's a great option as a middle ground. You say, well, I don't think I'm going to need it, medical assistance, but just in case I do, you've got a limit on what they'll get. I use that commonly when I'm conveying very large value properties. You convey a $1 million piece of property, okay, so they can get $300,000, but they can't get more than, and rarely are they going to get that much on estate recovery. Okay, a second option is to convey your property either with or without a reserved life lease. I like to reserve the life lease for insurance purposes, because when the insurance company knows that you actually have a right to that lease and you can enforce that right to lease, they will allow that property to be insured as a homeowner's rather than a dwelling fire and a renter's policy. But basically that will give you the same thing as the life estate as far as practical use is concerned, but there's no life estate, there's no step up in basis, but after 5 years, the state can't come back. So that's a done deal. On low value properties or on where there are a number of children, that's a pretty good option to use. And then and you can read the advantages and disadvantages that are put in there. Then the third one is the transfer on death designation. The transfer on death designation is very much like the transfer in death on your bank account, like on your anything else. When you die, it goes to your kids. It never starts the 5 years on medical assistance started. The 5 year look back never applies because you've never conveyed the property during your lifetime. So that if you think that you're going to need medical assistance, this is not the better choice. This is a good choice where you say, look, I'm never going to need medical assistance. I may want to sell that house in the future. That's the way to go. Okay, I'm told now I've only got about just a few minutes left, and now it's open for questions if anybody has any.